Coming up on Boston Public Radio, big day on Beacon Hill. Outside, a demonstration asking for the licensing of medical marijuana dispensaries to be expedited, and inside, a hearing on legalizing pot. To tax or not to tax, that will be our question for you. Then Global Post Charlie Sennett tackles a U.S. troop buildup in Eastern Europe, worldwide income inequality, and Sherpas on strike. Then, under the radar's Callie Crossley on a windfall for airlines coming from our pockets, where else, and a Roxbury church in retreat.
Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam, the guy who's written all these secret books we couldn't mention, well, his new book is out. It's a barn burner, and hallelujah, we're going to tell you all about it. Then, our TV guru Bob Thompson on Stephen Colbert's taking over for David Letterman and why America's not so mad about Mad Men anymore. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7. Jane Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We missed you, Marjorie. Welcome back.
I missed you too, Jim.
Well, it's good to see you. Today, marijuana advocates are descending on Beacon Hill. One group's calling on Governor Deval Patrick to expedite the licensing of medical marijuana dispensaries. And inside the State House, a bill to legalize, regulate, and tax marijuana is on the agenda for a hearing. Colorado has been the canary in the pot den, I guess you could say, and so far the canary is thriving. The Rocky Mountain State expects to bring in an estimated $98 million in state revenue this year, which exceeds the state's original expectations by 40%. So the question is quite simple at 877-301-8970. On the day that your elected representatives are holding a hearing on legalization, are you ready to support making marijuana legal in Massachusetts, which, by the way, is about 20% bigger than Colorado, which arguably would mean 20% more revenue? And could this be a better way, to put it in context, to raise money and create jobs than, say, casinos? We did a little research morning. The assumption is if Colorado raises $100 million from taxing marijuana and legalizing marijuana, obviously, as it did. And Washington State legalized it, too, but hasn't started implementing it. So let's say that's roughly $120 million in Massachusetts. Conservative but fair estimates on casinos, Marjorie, maybe twice that much, $240 million. So rather than just saying, sure, we'll take the money, if you had a choice, if you had to say you're a legislator, you're going to vote next, in 2016, if the legislature doesn't legalize marijuana, the public will vote in 2016 probably on the ballot. Which would you prefer to see legalized in this state, casinos, or which you may have a chance to repeal on the 2014 ballot, or the sale of marijuana? Our number is 877-301-8970.
You know, I think the question is, are you going to make more money as a better job, better wage, working in a pot shop? Are you going to make a better wage, a better job working in the casino, Jim? I'm not sure. A lot of people complain about many of the casino jobs winding up being not very high-paying jobs, and you might do better as a pot entrepreneur. I'm not sure.
Well, I forget entrepreneur. Somebody's got to listen. Since you brought it up, here's a clip from a news report on jobs created by Colorado's law, including a temp job agency. Listen, this is great. It's called Hemp Temps, and they needed to fill immediate staffing needs. Here it is.
As Colorado's marijuana industry begins to take off, its pot stores are busy hunting for labor, and temps fill a definite need.
We look for bud tenders, trimmers, growers, consultants, general laborers.
I love my job. I love every part about it. Some days I'm a trimmer, some days I'm a bud tender, some days I work in the garden. I mean, I get to go to different places every day, get to meet new people, get to do different things, don't get burnt out on one thing or another.
And there's just so many possibilities within this industry. Our business has skyrocketed.
Think about this. I mean, you could be there in the pot shop out in the where they grow all the pot. It's very peaceful. Like, you ever go to one of these nurseries and everybody's taking care of the plants out there? It's a very kind of, I think, soul-filling job, Jim, as opposed to being in the casino with the people, as you always put it, that looks like, you know, a Civil War hospital with their oxygen tanks.
At least one that I went to looked that way.
I mean, spending all their money they can't afford. I don't know. I think it might be a much more satisfying job to be a pot butter.
Can I tell you, it seems to me that if you were a fair-minded person in Massachusetts, even if you oppose legalization, you would conclude it's coming. Remember, in 2008, by more than 60%, the people of Massachusetts on a ballot campaign decriminalized up to, I think it was an ounce. 4 years later, the people of Massachusetts, by more than 60%, again against virtual unanimous opposition from the establishment, DAs, mm-hmm. police organizations, etc., legalized the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes. The assumption is in 2016 it's going to happen. The only argument I would make if I were a fair-minded elected official against voting to legalize it out of this hearing right now at the legislature,
what's that, Jim?
Is the canary that we talked about earlier. Colorado has an experiment. Washington's going to start its experiment, I think in June, I'm not sure, but in the next couple of months. What's the rush? Let's wait a couple of months. Let's get a sense if the revenue still is coming in. Let's get a sense if it turns out that there are not huge problems. And then if it's relatively smooth, you know, keep in mind, Marjorie.
This is my libertarian streak.
No, I know
I don't
think
the government has got any business regulating marijuana because,
you want it to regulate marijuana.
I want it to legalize marijuana.
And regulate it.
Well, tax it, but regulate marijuana in the sense that we're arresting people and sending people to jail. And for my money, if we were starting from scratch here, if you look at what is more harmful to society, alcohol versus marijuana, I think there's absolutely no question which is more harmful to society.
How would you describe the rollout of the medical marijuana dispensaries by the state government that would have to regulate the legalized marijuana it happen?
It's not been a very...
Utter chaos.
It's been utter chaos. But it's this guy that's holding this rally up on Beacon Hill today is pointing out, you know, what's really terrible here is that the political fighting and whether, you know, the licensing has been done as well as it should and whether the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted has prevented people with very serious diseases from getting the medical marijuana they may need and forced their relatives to go out into the black market.
But his point
and
my
and
point are not
law.
Mutually exclusive. I totally agree with him. But the fact is, if something that is more benign, I would argue, and easier to deal with, which is medicinal marijuana, less controversial, I would think, than recreational use legalization, has been such a mess in its rollout, I assume that it's legitimate to say, why should we have confidence that the state has the ability deal with a legalization rollout?
Part of the reason it's been a mess is the perspective from a lot of politicians, forget the shenanigans about the background of the people that are applying for licenses and all those kinds of things, is the attitude is you're putting these pot shops are like nuclear waste facilities or something.
No, that's a very good point.
These are people, we're talking about people, and obviously there's room for fraud, but we're talking about very sick people who get some relief from their suffering through marijuana.
Right.
And, oh, no, we can't put it near a school. Oh, no, we can't put it in downtown. Oh, no, we can't put it here. We can't put it there. Well, where should your grandmother go to get her marijuana? Should she go into the eighth floor of some backwater someplace out in the middle of an industrial plant? Or should she be able to go like a legitimate citizen making a legitimate purchase?
Well, you know what the solution is. The solution is for the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, to convince his boss that it should no longer be a Schedule I drug. The federal government should stop doing essentially reefer madness on the federal level. And you know what happened then? Then, I believe, unless I am wrong, you know where they could sell medical marijuana? CVS. Walgreens. The only reason they can't, the only reason an established business can't do it is because technically there are problems with dispensing marijuana of any kind because of the existing federal laws. And by the way, Eric Holder, to his credit, and I'm not a huge fan of his, is talking about reviewing thousands of convictions, you know, crack cocaine versus other kind of cocaine. He's doing a lot of things that would suggest that before this president leaves, that it's going to get out of the marijuana ban business. 877-301-8970. So your elected representatives, at least stage one, a hearing on a bill filed by Ellen Story from somewhere, I can't remember what city she's from, Amherst or one of those in Western Massachusetts, has filed a bill to legalize marijuana. The hearing is today in front of the Judiciary Committee. By the way, you know what the Judiciary Committee is doing on the exact same hearing?
They are taking up legislation in the wake of the puppy dough fiasco. You remember this terrible story about this poor little pit bull puppy. I'm not a big fan of pit bulls, but I sure am a big fan of puppies that was mistreated and tortured.
Horribly.
And eventually had to be put to sleep because its injuries were too extensive. Well, they're having a big hearing up at the State House today on the same subject, new tougher laws to regulate animal abuse. So it's pot. How are they going to do this? They're going to be up there all day long because the pro-pot people are very passionate. And obviously the pro-animal or the anti-animal abuse people are very powerful too, Jim. They could be there until 9 o'clock tonight.
You know, one of the incredible things, if you've never had the pleasure of testifying at a State House hearing, is, and I haven't done it in
it's
years
outrageous.
And years.
It's outrageous.
What you do is you get there hours before the hearing starts, so you assume you're first in line. But what you don't know is any elected official who comes in even a second before the mic opens gets to go ahead of you. So instead of going at 9, if that's when the hearing starts, you end up going at 2 or 3 or 4. And the other thing that's relatively odd, and this may have changed, I'm not sure, what if you have 42 bills on a hearing, like today I'm assuming they're 40 or 100 or whatever there are, but at least a couple of major ones, they take the witnesses after the elected officials in order, meaning you want to testify about animal cruelty. Okay, I get into that. The next testimony is on legalization of marijuana. The next is on whatever the bill. It's relatively chaotic and really frustrating.
You know what's terrible? The politicians rarely have anything to say. The people that are going to tell their stories, and we'll hear them today up at the State House about marijuana.
Yeah, both sides. Yeah.
Yeah, you'll hear them on both sides, but you'll also hear from a lot of people who say that they are themselves or their relatives are suffering.
Not about medicinal today. The hearing is not about medicinal. The rally is about medicinal.
But you're going to hear those same stories.
Oh, okay.
You're going to hear those same stories. And the point is, you hear them after the TV cameras have left and most of the reporters
have
left.
That's a very good point.
So they never even get on the news because all you get on the news is the politicians. It's very, 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 very frustrating.
In any case, we want to know if you support legalization. The bill is being heard today on Beacon Hill. Marjorie.
Oh, we have to take some calls here.
I know, she's been gone a day. It's not like riding a bicycle. You go away from this for a day and, like, you know what I mean?
Dan from Worcester. What do you think, Dan?
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Maggie and Jim.
Hey.
Couple of things. I agree with you, Maggie. I want the government out of my affairs, and if they, you know, stay away from this particular issue, that's part of me. But I know that there are people, who need medicinal marijuana, and I was listening to a doctor speaking about the issue, and he brought up the fact, one thing, he says, you know what? He says, there is no medication in medicine that you smoke. He says, if you won't need medicinal marijuana, he says, it should be processed by a company that does that, you know, whether it be a pill or an injection, and then a prescription given out by a doctor and, you know, followed through by that doctor to see that you've taken it and it's working for you. It's not something you go get in a cigarette form and smoke. I don't get it. That's where the criminality comes in. That's where all the crazy.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure you're right,
yes,
Dan. I'm not an expert on this. I am told that actually the benefits, at least for some users of medical marijuana, are completely connected to the smoking rather than the pill. But the reality, Dan, is it's the law. The public spoke. I know you're a libertarian-leaning guy, and I'm sure that's where your instincts come from here. But obviously there are going to be problems with whatever you legalize. But is there really any reason in 2014 for the state not to be making every dollar it can, number one? And number two, making sure that the marijuana people use recreationally is safe, so you at least know that it's been checked out by some government agency, no?
Well, yes, and that's particularly what this doctor was speaking about. It means if this product is taken into a laboratory setup and it's properly, you know, they take the chemicals out of it and they turn it into whether it be a pill or an injection or whatever, a serum, then you can tell now all the people that govern this stuff have looked at it and it's proper and okay, ready for dispense. That smoking of it, I don't know how you guys can figure that makes it better.
It's not my, Dan, let me be clear. Let me interrupt you, Dan. It's not my position. I don't know anything about it. I know what I've read, and what I've read is that the argument is that to get the full impact for some, that it's the smoking.
Well, I also think, Dan, it also has to do with the amount. I mean, people aren't smoking 20 joints or whatever we call them in 2014, you know, marijuana cigarettes a day. You know, the people that have serious problems with cigarettes they're probably taking with a powerful pot, like a hit or two hits. Everybody talks about how powerful the pot is. So you don't have the same sort of volume, obviously.
But, Dan, thanks for your call. We appreciate your call. You know, we want to be fair here, and there are arguments on the other side. Some people are concerned about the impact on teens, even though the law is proposed. I should have said this. The bill is proposed by Ellen Story. It would be just like alcohol. You're under 21. You can't do it legally, just like you can't buy a drink. One argument is made by Ricardo Baca. He was in the Colbert Report. He writes for the Denver Post cannabis blog. Here's his argument against this.
Let's say I have a friend who goes to Colorado over Christmas vacation and buys, how much can I buy?
So if you live in Colorado, if you're a resident, you can buy up to an ounce per day, I think. And then if you don't, you can live up to you can buy up to a quarter ounce per day.
That's a lot of pot. A quarter ounce a day? What confuses me most is if everybody in the state can have a quarter ounce of pot in their pocket, how will you indiscriminately arrest young black men?
That's an issue.
On what grounds will you imprison them?
It's obviously an issue that I hope the legislature is considering today.
He's great. He's going to be great on Letterman,
too. I hope
too,
so. 877-301-8970. We're going to talk to our friend Bob Thompson from Syracuse, the TV guru, later in the show about Colbert's ascension.
One last thing before we get back to the calls about the teen argument. The truth is, when you ask a lot of teenagers, they'll tell you that they're able to buy marijuana very easily right now in school. And lots of people tell you it's easier to get than alcohol because some liquor stores do actually card you when you go in to buy alcohol. You have to go through the hassle of getting your big brother or something like that or stealing from your parents or whatever. It would be, rather ironically, more closely regulated than it is now.
Yeah, one of my favorite things, speaking of alcohol for a second, one of my favorite things is when you go to a place like Whole Foods, for example. It's not just Whole Foods. You can be 120. You can literally be on death's door. And what do they ask you for if you're buying a six-pack?
God,
ID.
I love it.
Boy,
yeah, they do it Gillette, too, don't they? Gillette
Stadium? Do they? Is that so?
They do it Gillette. I think they might do
it at
Fenway.
Oh, at Fenway. They do. You're right.
It's a wonderful thing.
Let's go to stay in Boston, actually. I believe it's Dan. Dan,
hi,
you're
Dan.
Next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, hi. I have two things, actually. I'd say legalize it, especially in the cities. I mean, you got so many college students, you'll make far more money in taxes on in Colorado. Plus,
that's a great point.
That is a great point.
Yeah. And then also with the casinos, I mean, if you have a company next to a store or a restaurant next to the casino, you're not going to be doing as well. But if you have a cookie shop next to a pot shop in Boston, you're going to make far more money on taxes on that cookie shop than the casinos are going to make.
Dan has obviously thought quite a bit about this. Dan, you're quite the entrepreneur. Thank you.
About the girl, what was the story about the Girl Scout
outside San Francisco? This kid, I'm sure you read about this a few weeks ago.
Great.
She set up her Girl Scout cookie stand outside a medical marijuana dispensary, I think in San Francisco. And didn't she sell out like in minutes or something?
Those Thin Mints, it was unbelievable. They were flying, literally, off her little stand there.
A serious point that Dan made, we did a little math upstairs. There are 5 million plus people in Colorado. There's 6 million plus people in Massachusetts. The projected revenue in the first year in Colorado is $98 million. So we assumed 120 was a fair number. But Dan makes a wonderful point. When you've got a concentration of college, I don't think there's any state that has the concentration per capita of college kids as Massachusetts does. That's obviously going to increase the tally, which means there's probably going to be more money, 140, 150, whatever it is, which rapidly approaches the casino count. And one of the things about casinos, when you and I have talked about this a lot on and off the air, is casino, despite the positive projections of the proponents, both in the casino industry and in the legislature who supported it, it's a tough time for casinos
It is. And many people argue that we're reaching a saturation point and that the revenues in some of these casinos have gone down. They've not done nearly as well as people expected. We've talked about this a million times in terms of the Twin Rivers in Rhode Island that's had tough times. They're not making the money in Connecticut.
The saturation is not just intra-casino industry. The saturation in Massachusetts is we've got everything. We've talked about this a million times, from lottery tickets to Keno on your dinner table at a restaurant
That's a good point.
Virtually, I mean, there are a lot of opportunities to bet.
Playing Keno.
I know you do.
Over my plate of lasagna.
I know. It's nothing. And by the way, the thing I love that they did a couple of years ago, remember when they reduced the time between Keno games? I think it's from 5 minutes to 4 minutes. You can lose money faster while you're eating your meal. It's really a great thing. Michael and Newton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, guys. I think the toxic waste thing, the nuclear waste point, is a pretty good one. I lived in the Netherlands for a year, and I had a quote-unquote coffee shop around the corner from my apartment. And nothing happened. The only difference is that the cops aren't wasting their time trying to bust people who are buying and selling pot. But otherwise, the Dutch don't smoke pot significantly more than anybody else does. It's just that law enforcement isn't spinning its wheels trying to enforce these laws.
Is that actually true, that the marijuana usage of the average citizen of Holland is not much higher than places where it's not legal?
I was friends with a lot of Dutch people, and I mean, it's anecdotal. I'm sure there are statistics that I don't have at my fingertips, but the people, when you walk past the coffee shops, the people that you saw inside were mostly us and tourists. like Americans and British people, and the Dutch were just kind of not interested. It was boring because it was something they could just go and get whenever they wanted it.
Yeah, makes sense. Michael, thank you for the call. I know it's a tired argument. You made it. I've made it a million times. But you really can't make it credible. Even though you can make a credible case, that there's still some open questions about the health impacts, the negative health impacts, particularly on young people. You can't make a case
ridiculous...
in a society where alcohol is legal that marijuana shouldn't
be. And you look at crime, whether it's murder or domestic violence or it's drunk driving or all these things, all these terrible crimes, many times people are significantly, they're drunk or they're almost drunk. And you know, the studies that have been done so far about driving on high on marijuana, not that you should, obviously, versus driving drunk. I mean, you're better off if you're going to do one, you should do neither, but you're better off with the pot than you are with the liquor. 877-301-8970. Sean from Dedham. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Great.
Hey, Timmy, why don't we do this? I don't care for either one of these vices, but why don't we just fill the casino and let them sell the marijuana in the casino, and that's the only place, and then I'll sell Doritos outside in the parking lot on the way out, and I'll be able to pay my mortgage, and that way everyone can be happy. Even how about the people on EBT? Let them make money selling something. I don't know.
Took you 10 seconds to figure out how to get that EBT thing in there. You know, by the way, I'm not a casino expert, but I think we all know that it is in the interest of the casino operators to make sure that the casino customers drink as much as they possibly can. And so while you were saying that three quarters in jest, Sean, if it becomes legal, you don't think one of the first places to say we want it regulated marijuana to be sold here is in the casinos and the slots parlor? I mean, of course, that's what it's going to be.
Sean,
thanks for the call.
Thank you for the call, Sean, as always. 877-301-8970. The marijuana legalization hearing is going on up at the State House this afternoon, and outside, the people that are pushing for the get-goingness on this legalization of, well, we've already legalized the medical marijuana, but actually opening up these facilities so people who want to get medical marijuana, as the voters approved, can actually get the medical marijuana. That's going on up at the State House, too. So it's going to be a big marijuana day up on Beacon Hill.
Before you go ahead, in light of the call we just got from the guy who lived in Holland for your Time magazine, and thank you to one of our colleagues who just did the research, Time magazine reports marijuana usage in Holland is on a par with averages in Europe and far lower than rates in the United States, where, as we all know, it's illegal, making his point and then some.
Well, lots of people. I mean, you hear this all the time for people that were, you know, young in the sex, drugs, and rock and roll days. You know, they may have smoked marijuana when they were 20. They're not smoking it when they're 40 or 50, or a lot of them talk about how it makes them paranoid and nervous wrecks and stuff like that. So, again, it would take away. And by the way, in these states that have legalized marijuana, like Colorado, a lot of the money, just like with the gambling thing here, is going toward prevention and going toward dealing with people who wind up having a psychological addiction to marijuana.
Well, I'm assuming here as well, if it turns out that this bill gets anywhere in the legislature. And the reason it's going to get somewhere is having a little personal experience in this piece myself. When there's a potential ballot questioning hanging over the legislature, it often causes them to do things they might not otherwise want to do. I think most of them are scared of the notion of legalizing marijuana, even though privately they'd probably say to you, what's the problem? $120, $140 million is welcome revenue. But in light of the fact there's a ballot question coming, and I think the conventional wisdom would be it will do as well as the two prior marijuana-related questions, each of which got more than 40% of the vote, I'm assuming that pressure is going to cause them to do at least something in the next year.
See. By the way, if we mentioned this, I don't think you did, Jim. We didn't. We should have. Jonathan just emailed this about, obviously, in addition to the increase in tax revenue, you're going to reduce the cost. The prison costs, arresting nonviolent offenders and prosecuting them and having them go through the already overwhelmed court system and going to the already overwhelmed prison system.
Even though it's Massachusetts, you know more about this than I do. I don't think Massachusetts is one of the top states in terms of prosecuting marijuana possession sales. Like, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people in jail around the country because of marijuana. Most of them dealers, not possessors, but some possessors as well. That's not a staple of the Massachusetts criminal justice system, is it, or is it? I don't know,
to tell you the truth. I don't know if it is or it isn't. I think a lot of the people that are in jail for marijuana stuff are federal
That's
people.
A good point, actually.
But I am not sure how many people are in Massachusetts jails because of marijuana. Anyway, Chris from New Bedford. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hi there, guys.
Hey.
How are you?
Great.
Great.
I have to say, I listen to you guys every day. I love you.
Well, you're kind
thank
to
you.
Do that. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. So, I'm a legal grower, caregiver/patient in New Bedford.
And one of the things that I'd like to say about, well, I'm pro-legalization across the board. The reality is that marijuana is everywhere already. The best thing we could possibly do is, you know, pull these, a lot of them young people especially, out of the shadows and out of the black market and actually give them real jobs.
Yeah.
Because it's not, one, it's not easy. And it's not cheap. It's an expensive endeavor to begin with just to grow it. You really have to know what you're doing. And there's a lot of people that actually have these skills that under the current circumstances are criminals. And they don't need to be criminals.
Chris, did you say you're a legal grower?
I am a legal grower under the current Massachusetts medical marijuana law, yes.
Okay.
Now, get this, though. Only until the dispensary is open, at which point there's no provision for someone like me. I would be known as a caregiver. I grow for a family member, and I grow 100% organically. I know exactly what goes into it. It's safe.
So what do you mean? That essentially, I wasn't aware of this, dispensaries gain a monopoly once the licenses are formally offered?
Yeah, I thought you could still grow some of your own, Chris. Am I mistaken?
Yeah, the way that it works is you can, under the law, you can have a hard, now they don't even have any of this set up for the caregivers or anyone else at this point either, just to show you how bad the state is doing with this. Everything keeps getting put back. I'd love to register with the state as a caregiver. I'd love to pay taxes. I'm not actually selling it, I'm providing it to my family members, but I'm saving money.
Can I interrupt you to make a suggestion? Next time Governor Patrick is in the studio for an hour, call in, make your case. I think you've got a pretty compelling one. He's got a little bit of power on Beacon Hill still. I would suggest you call and bring up your point. I think it's a good one. Chris, thanks for the call. Before we go, it's almost impossible, Marjorie, you ever do a segment on this.
Uh-huh.
And people feel let down if you don't, to play a little bite from Reefer Madness. Now, for those who haven't seen it, and if you haven't, I don't know what's wrong with you. This is in 1935.
Was cult it 1935?
Film. 36, I'm off God. By 1 year. Cult classic that is totally unfair to play in the middle of a debate about this, but you can't resist. Here it is.
These high school boys and girls are having a hop at the local soda fountain. Innocently, they dance. Innocent of a new and deadly menace lurking behind closed doors. Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell.
I think the symbol was the key. Was that a symbol? Whatever that thing was, they banged.
With
I think that was pretty critical.
In hell. Okay.
Gong, thank you, John.
Thank
and by
you.
The way, we should reiterate what we said at the beginning. The reason we're talking about this, if you want to follow it, is there's a hearing in front of the Judiciary
yep.
Committee on Beacon Hill today, tomorrow morning in your newspaper, tonight on your news,
that's
or right,
right
here on GBH. You'll hear how the hearing went.
And there's a puppy dough hearing as well
to
tighten up
yep.
the laws on animal abuse. Okay, when we come back, Charlie Sennett joins us to go over global headlines. Jim spoke to Charlie yesterday. They spoke about everything from a Sherpa boycott to a best-selling book on income inequality and how the two are connected. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH through our vehicle donation program. Visit wgbh.org/car donation.
From hurricanes to healthcare to the Boston Marathon bombing, why all the events of the past year have made us stronger. I'm Kara Miller, this week on Innovation Hub, tonight at 9 on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Cityside Subaru on Route 60 in Belmont, featuring the new Crosstrek Hybrid, Subaru's highest MPG all-wheel drive vehicle. More information available online at citysidesubaru.com. And Seasons 4, for 44 years, the outdoor living store on Mass Ave in Lexington, featuring over 100 styles of furniture and a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories. April event now in progress. Seasons4.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brady. Sherpas are packing up and walking out. In honor of the 16 mountain guides who died in that recent avalanche on Mount Everest, they've issued a 7-day ultimatum to the government. If the Sherpa won't come to the mountain, will the mountain come to them? And how is it that a 700-page book, which takes on Adam Smith and Karl Marx, could be a number one bestseller? because economic inequality is a global reality, something my guest Charlie Sennett knows a lot about. He's here with me in Studio 3 to go over these and other global headlines. Charlie is the vice president and co-founder of Global Post. Charlie, great to see you.
Great to see you.
Before we get to Mount Everest and the Great Divide, as it's called in the Global Post, tell me why I shouldn't be concerned that the United States is sending 600 ground troops to Eastern Europe almost immediately after the president reassured us yet again that we have ruled out the use of force in our dealings with Russia around Ukraine.
Well, I think you shouldn't be concerned that there's some kind of imminent confrontation between those 600 troops and Russia. I mean, that is nothing that anyone listening should suddenly realize they're going to be sleepless about. But I do think it's a very important message that the Obama administration is sending to reassure allies, as they keep saying. And the takeaway I have on this, when you're talking about 600 troops, is a pretty big number. You know, it's not that small an issue that we shouldn't pay very close attention. They'll be coming from the 173rd Infantry out of Italy. It's not the first time we've sought to reassure allies. We do this through history, and it's important that we do it now. I think what's happening in the Ukraine is happening with a precipitousness and a seriousness that continues to surprise. So I think it's a very good, cautious, and important move to reassure allies. That said, I think we have to look in the much larger context of this, and that would include China in this mix. And that is that the United States is being challenged by Russia and China on two very important fronts. And there is a sense right now in geopolitics of Russia and China trying to throw their elbows around. And I think that the White House feels this greatly. They, of course, feel it in the Ukraine. But if you look at the trip now that Obama is on in China, the same issue is resonant in the air, right? He arrives in Japan today, trip to Asia. He will not be visiting China, but he arrives in Japan today and will have these meetings in which China will be the elephant in the room. Even though the meetings will not take place with China, clearly the threat that China poses in the South China Sea and the threat that it poses throughout Asia is a very big deal. And I think this White House is recognizing it needs to reassure its allies in a very clear and dramatic way.
By the way, the two other elephants, to use your terminology, which obviously are going to distract a lot of these discussions, a plane that may be at the bottom of the ocean and a ship that is sunk with a couple of hundred teenagers still on it.
But the rescues there, have you been reading about those? That was handed up and out.
I have to say, but the flip side is some of the most heartbreaking stuff I've ever heard in my life are the texts that were sent by some of the kids to their parents or their siblings from the ship, and then you'll read at the bottom, it's unclear if this person survived. It's an horrific story. But can we just stay on Ukraine just for a couple of seconds? There's not a day that I don't read another analysis of what the real agenda of Putin is. Mm-hmm. Is it Eastern Ukraine? Is it to recreate a mini Soviet Union? What's your take, Charlie? I mean, assuming that this guy is not out there, as the chancellor of Germany said about a month ago, assuming he actually is conscious of what he's doing and has an agenda, what is the agenda? What is it?
Well, I think Putin's agenda needs to be analyzed in the context of like The Sopranos. Yeah, that's how you have to think of this guy. He's a thug, and he's in a place right now where he knows very logically, very strategically, he needs the Crimea. And he is not going to give up the Crimean Peninsula, and he's not going to let go of his control on that. And I think there's increasing evidence that he was planning this all through the Olympics. So right while there was all this wonderful new face of Russia being exhibited to the world, there was at the same time a growing recognition that Putin felt challenged by an expansion of NATO, which is undeniably something that has happened and that does challenge his authority in his backyard. And he has some logic in trying to exert control there. You can't deny that. The way he's doing it, I think, is reckless, and I think it's gotten to be much more serious. When we first talked about this a few weeks back, I was among the many who were saying, this is going to quiet down, we're going to see diplomacy. Yeah. But I think now we're talking about a sort of muscle flexing that may have a momentum of its own. I think it's serious, and I think it's why it really matters that President Obama has decided to send the 600 troops into Eastern Europe and to say, hey, we're going to actually take some actions here to really reassure our allies because this is getting to be
but
important.
But what's next? Is it Eastern Ukraine? Is it Moldova? I mean, what is it? What is it that he – where else will he flex his muscles?
I think what's next is the election in the Ukraine. And I think in the lead up to that election on May 26th is going to be a lot of tension but not a lot of action. I don't think there's enough time for Putin to exert any really dramatic incursion into Eastern Ukraine or something, you know, to have some sense that he could actually pull that off. I don't think he can. But I do think this is a pivotal moment. This is a time when Putin has tremendous popular support at home, and Obama is acutely aware that this situation is getting more and more serious. And truthfully, I don't know where it's headed. We're going to be there. So Global Post is there on the ground now with a correspondent. But I'm also planning to go over and really look at the situation at the election as well. So I think I'll know more from the lay of the land. I think it's very hard to read. The analysts, as you've pointed out, are all over the map.
Speaking of all over the map, your people are all over the map on this grand series you were doing called The Great Divide. We know that there's a huge, whether it's Pope Francis or Barack Obama or everybody in between, there's been a lot of focus on income inequality. You're looking at it everywhere. Tell people what the theme is and what the goal is of what you guys are doing at Global Post on this.
Sure. So this was a year-long effort of reporting, which we are calling The Great Divide, rising income inequality around the world and why we need to care about it is the idea. What we did is we took economic data known as Gini coefficients.
G-I-N-I, for those who don't know.
Named after an Italian economist who you'd know from reading this incredibly white-hot book that's out now called
Thomas
Capital.
Thomas Piketty thing, yeah.
Yeah, this book is like today, it became the bestseller on Amazon globally. So this is a huge book, paying very close attention to why income inequality is such a serious issue. But for the last year, we've looked at it by taking that Gini coefficient and analyzing where are the most unequal places in America? How can we look at income inequality in the United States and then see where that same level of inequality is reflected in the world?
My favorite is Bangkok, Thailand, and Fairfield County, Connecticut. So after I was able to close my mouth after it had dropped open when I read that comparison, why do we care about the fact that there is the same level of that there as there is 100, 200 miles away from us?
Right. So to be clear, the highest point of income inequality in America, as you point out, is Fairfield County, Connecticut. It's so dramatic, the difference between the top 10% and the bottom 10%, that it compares statistically, the distance between those two quintiles compares directly to Bangkok, Thailand. Now, why do we need to care about that? Because when we think about Thailand, we think about teeming slums and a sliver of an elite that shops in very shiny malls in Bangkok that we may have been through on a family vacation. We don't think of it as a place where there's mobility, right? Yet what's happening in America is that we are no longer capable of the mobility within our economy that we think of ourselves as having. The American dream has been something we've all been raised on and that we've all been taught to believe in, and it is vanishing. And it's very hard for us to get our heads around that unless we begin to look at the data and see that the OECD, so this is the organization that coordinates the 30 most industrialized countries in the world, it ranks the United States as 29th out of 30 for economic mobility, defined as the ability to go from that bottom 10% to the top 10%.
Yeah, but people still believe in this country. I read in one of your pieces that sort of Ronald Reagan, I think, elevated this to an art form, convincing people that if you work hard and have dreams, that you can go from that bottom quintile, a term he wouldn't use, but you know what I mean, the bottom quintile to at least close to the top quintile. Many Americans still believe that, right?
I think they do, and I hope they always will, and I know I do. Like, I still believe in this idea, and I think it's what really distinguishes our country is that if you work hard and you have a great idea, the best idea wins, and it can win in the economy. I hope we never lose that idea. And when we study income inequality, I try to always be very clear with people. We're not arguing for complete income equality, that everyone should be paid the same thing. What we're really talking about is equal opportunity. Are we, as a country, still creating the opportunity for that bottom 10% to get up to that higher level above them, to climb the rungs up to
the 10%. But that 29th ranking would suggest that despite your best hopes that we don't have that level of mobility.
We have let this slip, and we need to look at some really hard-to-understand data and start to get our head around how the United States has lost the American dream. And we need to keep it alive. We need to keep it restored. I mean, anyone who's trying to put their kid through college right now, and I just came off my first college tour, right? I did the classic, you know, sort of...
Gets far worse, trust me.
I did Colby, Bates, Bowdoin, and I'm up there with my oldest son, Will, and I'm looking at the price tag on this. I mean, this is impossible. Whatever happened to the Pell Grants? Whatever happened to the idea that we could actually get a great college education? If you're a smart kid, you could get into one of those schools. We've created through our education system, and we are creating through our economy, and we have to be candid, through tax policies that have favored the very wealthy, we've created an inequality in America that I think is stripping out and really gutting out that core idea of equal opportunity.
But assume for a moment that unlike the Pope, who bases a huge part of his position about the issues of income inequality as a moral issue. Assuming you're amoral, not you, assuming one is amoral, again, getting back to the one of the basic themes of the Great Divide that you're doing at Global Post, you've been doing, so what? I mean, it's horrible and it's unfair, but why should we care? Why should we care that people not only are at the bottom, but have fewer and fewer opportunities even in our midst to get out of the bottom?
We need to care because the engine of America's growth and its success is the idea of opportunity. So we need to restore and rekindle that idea by actually looking very hard at the data at how far it's diminishing. Because at some point, the reality of this country, the recognition of the facts on the ground are going to catch up with the dream or the cliche we hold up to ourselves. We have to look in the mirror and see we've changed. We've aged a lot. We're balding. We're not quite
staring at me when he said that for those who are not watching us streaming, which luckily
like I said, it's a mirror, Jim. It's a mirror.
Pause. Did you notice? Could you hear the pause? We are balding, Jim.
Well, I was about to say, and getting overweight, and that would come back at me.
So I think you're looking fine.
I think we need to think about this seriously, really seriously think about how do we, as a country, keep the core of what we really believe in about ourselves, because it is absolutely the engine of our growth and our success and why we are looked up to throughout the world. If we lose that, or if we continue to lose that, I should say, because we are losing it, we threaten to undermine this. So Capital, this book by Piketty, this is what he gets at. He says, the idea is that capital is going to surpass the economy. And when that happens, capitalism begins to implode. It begins to cave in on itself. And this is classic Marxian economics. I mean, this is not exactly
new. We're not talking Groucho in this particular case, right?
No, but I mean, I remember being at UMass Amherst, you know, in the early 80s, the beginning of Reagan, with a radical critique up in that lefty Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts. And I remember hearing a great economics professor, Sarah Lennox, talking about this very issue. And if you look at Piketty's graphs in this book, Capital, which is now like a white-hot bestseller, if you look at the graphs, you'll see that the year really is 1979, 1980, the graph of where we had a broad swath of a middle class that was growing. That begins to fall apart in 1980 with a change in tax policy. And we begin to say, look, we're gonna relieve some of the tax policies that have hit the rich hard. And maybe that was right for the time, and it spurred great economic growth. But it has now reached a point where it's out of control.
Yeah, but Marjorie and I actually totally coincidentally were talking about this a couple of days ago. We had an author on who'd written about how this state of public higher education and its lack of affordability and the Pell Grants you talked about were destroying, literally using the same language as you, the American dream. And Marjorie and I both, we mentioned the other day, and we've mentioned in the past, that one of the things that changed from that period in the 80s that you described, with the exception of the Occupy movement, the short-lived Occupy movement, this is a society, American society, that basically will allow anyone to beat us with a stick. I don't mean internationally. I mean internally. Mm-hmm. You know this far better than I, since you've traveled the world. In France, in Montreal, if they raise the cost of public higher education by $10 a year, there'll be 200,000 people on the street as fast as you can count to 10. In the United States, it seems to me one of the major, the level of activism,
yeah,
where we watch cable television, we listen to the radio, and we respond to pollsters to say how upset we are and how dysfunctional our elected leaders are. But the disappearance of activism, it seems to me, is what moves us to the bottom of that list of 30. Because in a lot of those other nations, the reason there's hope is because people rise up to change things. We don't rise up to do anything. Some of us go to vote. Is that not a fair description?
I think it's a fair description. Is this your call to action?
Well, I mean, I don't have the ability to call anybody to action, but I think there's a calculus that's made by people in office that the likelihood, if they reject popular will, I mean, a perfect example, which is not part of income inequality, but it's the background check thing. When 90% of the American people said we support it, Congress, the Senate proposes a modified version of it, and even that can't make it through the United States Senate because there are no consequences for most of this in this society, no matter what is done.
These are broad economic trends that you could argue really go back to technology. That technology has changed our economy in a way that we have not figured out yet how to harness technology in terms of sustainable living for people to have productive lives. That's really what's going on. So our next big special report on Global Post, which we're doing right now, and we're out in the field reporting on this right now, and we're partnering with PRI The World, GBH,
great
PRI partner, and we're really looking at the issue of youth unemployment around the world, because that is that's the other side of the coin of income inequality, is that young people are not able to find meaningful work around the world. This is true in Detroit as much as it is in Madrid, and it's absolutely devastatingly true in places like Nigeria, where you get like 70% of those between the ages of 15 and 24 are neither employed nor in school. And there's a tattoo in Lagos now that a lot of young people are getting, which says, born throwaway.
Oh, my God.
And this is this sense of despair will set in. So I think the other flip side, there's despair in a place like Nigeria, but there's a lot of creativity in places like Egypt, where the Facebook revolution took place. There are angel investors all over Cairo looking at people in Egypt who really understand the web, who created social action through it. It's not all bad news. It's just a disruptive time and a time to pay close attention to how you kindle the flame for an entrepreneurial spirit globally in an age of technology.
Let's talk about one more issue of income inequality. Now, virtually every place, hotspot in the world that one can mention you've been to, you've covered, just tell me you have not climbed Mount Everest. Is that
you have not?
Okay. Talk about income inequality. Everybody
Washington.
Heard this horrible story. Sherpas, you know, are these legendary mountain people who essentially are the people who facilitate, without whom there would not be climbs at the cost of $75,000 a person or thereabouts, climbing Mount Everest. People know there was an avalanche. 16 people were killed. 13 of them, from what I understand, were Sherpas. One of the worst climbing accidents in the history of Everest. I don't know if you've read this, but again, this is where the income inequality comes in.
That's right.
They are being offered, the families are being offered $415 per person, per family, for the people who died. And as a result, and I have to find, as horrible as the first part of the story is, I find this really inspirational in some ways. They're planning to go on strike. The Sherpas are planning on boycotting, without them, there's no climbing of Mount Everest. You have a smile on your face,
well,
too.
Well, I have a smile because it is this deep tragedy, horrific accident, but it reveals, as you've pointed out, income inequality in a way that you could never do it through statistics, or that Piketty could do through his huge Bible-thick book, right? What it does is it shows you that there are people who can afford to pay $75,000 for the experience of a lifetime, and the value of that life, as set by the Nepalese government, that life that allows them to get to the top, that carries all of the camping equipment, that without whom they would not survive a day, that life is worth $415. That doesn't have any relation to what they get paid to do the hike for the day.
Which is a fraction of that,
They're factoring that out as a life's worth. It's stunning inequality. It's the most dramatic form I could see. And I agree with you, Jim. I see it as really heartening that these guys are just walking off base camp and saying, we're not going to do this anymore. And I think we need to hear these kind of stories, and we need to keep being reminded of how really wildly out of sync we are in understanding that the world has become tremendously divided. We need to care about that. If we're really going to have a future in which we have opportunity, where we're really going to have sustainability, we're going to have to start thinking about the hard math on inequality.
Couldn't agree more. Charlie Sennett, The Great Divide is a terrific thing. It's being done by the Global Post. Check it out at globalpost.com. Charlie is the vice president and co-founder of the Global Post. Charlie, it's great to see you.
Thanks, Jim.
Up next, Callie Crossley joins us for her take on the big headlines and the stories that flew under the radar this week. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
How do you solve a problem like migraine?
Migraine happens to be the third most common medical disorder on the planet. Among women, it is the fourth most disabling. It is a major public health problem.
The massive public health and economic implications of new drugs to better manage migraine with neurologist David Dodick. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Summer Investigative Reporting Workshop for high school students at Boston University, where students learn critical thinking and research skills, how to do in-depth reporting, interviewing, and more. NECIR.org/summer. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, committed to providing patients with quality cancer care, innovative services, and personalized treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley Sunday nights. Now, if you're feeling a little off kilter, do not worry. It is Thursday. You did not fall through a tear in the time-space continuum. Callie Crossley does usually join us on Fridays, but Mayor Marty Walsh will be here tomorrow noon to 1. So, Callie, we're getting a head start on your take on the week's news. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Callie. So, I am very excited about this Lupita Nyong'o getting People Magazine's Most Beautiful Woman in the World, because People Magazine does determine all these things, as we know. But what's your take on this?
I have so many takes on it. First of all, I'm really excited. For people who don't know, Lupita Nyong'o is the star of 12 Years a Slave. She plays a pivotal character, Patsy, who has several critical scenes in the movie. And, you know, sometimes they're a little hard to watch, but she is so fabulous in her portrayal.
And she won an Oscar.
And she won an Oscar for that. She also won on the red carpet, because everywhere she went,
fantastic.
She looked fantastic.
That blue dress with the plunging neckline.
And the necklace.
She was gorgeous.
I love it. I love the red cape Tom Ford one, too. That was wonderful, too. So anyway, she's conquered all of those fields, and everybody's feeling really good about her. And she's, you know, has what an Oscar winner gets to do, which is to sift through several, you know, potential new roles. And then all of a sudden this happens. And it's so interesting for many reasons. First of all, magazines, as a rule, really try to stay away from African-Americans because their sales go down. I mean, that's not something I'm making up. That's just a fact. So that she's chosen, and they decided that she's, for whatever their calculations are, their algorithms, that it they can ride it out and it's worth it. And that's great. She's new, not in the business, but new on this kind of platform, this kind of worldwide attention. And usually they pick an established actress,
yep,
like a Jennifer Lopez, like a Jennifer Aniston, you know, somebody like that who's been around, a Gwyneth Paltrow. And obviously, you know, when you think beauty in this country, it's generally not somebody who looks like Lupita Nyong'o. And so that for me is really interesting. And I wanted to point out that she herself is aware of, even before she got this honor, of how much her presence and being accorded all of this high praise for how she looked, as well as what she did, was really important to young women out there. She spoke at a Black Women in Hollywood luncheon a few months during the middle of all of the awards that she was winning. And this is what she said. I remember a time when I too felt unbeautiful. I put on the TV and only saw pale skin. I got teased and taunted about my night-shaded skin. And my one prayer to God, the miracle worker, was that I would wake up lighter skinned. And then she goes on to talk about, you know, how that changed. And she ends by saying, and so I hope that my presence on your screens and in the magazines may lead you, young girl, on a similar journey, that you will feel the validation of your external beauty, but also get to the deeper business of being beautiful inside. There is no shade in that beauty. So yeah. Turns out she's a beautiful
person
as well. Well, also, yeah. Obviously, the previous black women that were on the cover were biracial women, yeah. Halle Berry and Beyonce.
Yeah. Well, Beyonce has two black parents, thank you. Well, I know what you mean.
But her mother's also Native American and very light-skinned. Mm-hmm. You look at Beyonce's mother and you don't know what she is. She certainly is not a dark-skinned black woman.
That's right.
And you know this, obviously, better than certainly I do. The whole thing about how dark is your skin, you know, among African-American beauty things. It's a big deal.
Well, it's not just beauty. What is also the most egregious example of the issue of the darkness of one's skin in the history of magazine covers?
Yep.
I remember when O.J. Simpson. Was it Time or Newsweek that artifically darkened his skin?
I thought it was
skin?
Time.
I can't remember. Whichever it was to make him look more menacing at the time of the murder trial.
And actually, speaking of Beyonce, various magazine covers have altered her skin color, believe it or not. And there's been a lot of pushback against that. So this is a big deal on so many fronts. And needless to say, Lupita is very excited about it. And I think it's great. And I'll be interested to see where the comments are and how the sales go and all of that.
Oh,
but what a great honor for
her. Maybe you shouldn't look at the comments.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yeah. What?
I'm only a denizen of People magazine, which I love when I'm at the dentist. So I don't get to see it that often. But I do go to the dentist fairly regularly. Is most beautiful person of the year and sexiest person of the year two separate issues? Oh, it is two separate kinds.
Yeah. And they do men and women.
Oh, they do.
You know what? You know what? I've got to say this because people said People magazine, oh my goodness, it's ridiculous. Well, when a big story comes along, like some big national tragedy, whether it was, I didn't follow their coverage of the Boston Marathon, but say Columbine, or they do.
Yeah, they
good
do.
Work.
Really
yeah, they do.
Good reporting.
They do.
I mean, they got a lot of money. They got a lot of bodies to throw on the ground.
Well, so they humanize stories pretty well. From my limited reading, they do a good job of making things.
And they usually find some people that you haven't heard from before, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, they do. They do a good job. Yeah. Besides just the pictures of all the celebrities. Mm.
By the way, one of the things that, as Chet was dying, the great Chet Curtis.
Yes.
And I was visiting him at his house in Quincy. It was a few weeks before he passed away. One of the things he was proudest of. You know, you're doing reminiscing and stuff. There was a story about him and Natalie Jacobson in People magazine when they were in their prime.
A multi-page story.
Wow. And it was, he's been virtually every paper in America. And that was the one that he really, really loved, which meant a lot to
me. It means you've hit the people then at that
it
point.
It has. Okay. Now, this story, you go for it, Margaret. I'm so into this.
I didn't even know this was true, this scam with these unused airline tickets. Please explain this to people. This is really outrageous.
Well, if you fly a lot, and really, even if you don't fly a lot, it's a big old hassle now, and they're hitting you for every fee imaginable. One airline at one point was charging you for water, and they had to back off from that. But anyway, so with all the fees that they're now charging you, they've tightened down on every regulation. So you buy a ticket, and my goodness, something happens, and you can't go that day. Well, then they charge you a change fee. So the change fee used to be $150, which was bad enough. Now it's gone up for most airlines, except for Southwest. Thank you, Southwest, to $200. All right. So if your ticket, however, was $150 these days, that would be highly unlikely. But anyway, if you happen to get that, now you're doubling the price of the ticket. And sometimes they make you pay the gap in between of what the ticket has now gone up to. And, there are circumstances beyond your control often. So their answer is, well, then you should buy the fully refundable ticket, which is usually the difference between the $300 ticket and the $1,200 ticket. So who can afford that? That's why you're buying the $300 ticket. And they just sit on them. So they just, you can't cash them in. You can't use them as you would if you were using award miles or something and you don't use them. They now charge you a fee to turn them back in, but at least you could piece them back together and put another ticket together using award miles. But if you've paid for the ticket, cold hard cash, thank you very much, you're just out of luck.
And by the way, listen to some of these numbers. For those who don't realize, everybody knows how the airlines are taking it out of our pockets. $2.5 billion in cancellation fees last year, 2012, up from only $915 million in 2007. And the guy who brought us the consumer movement and unsafe at any speed, this should be called unaffordable at any speed, Ralph Nader, is at the center of this thing. And the point about the story, it's one of these things, the airline industries, the power is colossal. I mean, look back, for example, everybody celebrates the 9/11 compensation fund.
Right.
Why did Congress establish it? Not to give money to the victims' families, yeah. but to hold the airline industry immune from litigation. That was the only reason that originated. And then they said, we can't just do that. We got to help the people. But the incredible part of this to me is it's one thing if you charge the exorbitant fee and they can't sell the ticket. But a point is made in all the stuff we read today is that virtually every flight is full. So yes. if you cancel your ticket, Callie Crossley, yeah. even if it's frivolous, forget if there's a need, and they sell the seat, okay, charge you $25 for the labor or the staff time, whatever, but it doesn't change. So they essentially get to charge double, which is where the $2.5 billion comes from. It's scandalous.
And
my point is, why
doesn't
Congress do anything about it? Because the airline industry owns Congress.
Yeah,
well,
there you go.
The industry owns seems to own everyone in Congress, which is another reason why we need term limits so we can finally get something done around there. But it's just really disgraceful. But let me ask you one other thing. Is there like a little grace period? Because I don't fly very much. If you order a ticket at 105 today, and 110, I'm stuck.
No, and I've made an error where you're doing it online, and I've made an error, and I were, oh my God, I don't want to go there. I've called and said, literally, I just hit the wrong button. I'm going to buy a ticket. I just don't want to go to Kansas. I'm trying to go to wherever. Well, too bad. You just better go to Kansas at some point, or you just own that ticket. That's very sad for you.
Should I make an admission since the statute of limitations is run? I think I violated some ethical thing, but it happened many, many years ago. I was on a flight.
Yeah, I bet.
And
here we go.
No, it's not. It's you wouldn't do it, but and I
he
shouldn't.
Said,
have.
I'm an anchor man.
Well, pretty close. I fought for about 2 months with what's the airline's based in Dallas? Is it American Airlines?
Yes,
I think it's American.
Yeah.
I fought for a couple of months over something. And I have to say, I was right. It wasn't just me whining as I often do. I was really right. They had made it totally dealt with me in an unfair way about a ticket. I got to the gate. I was in a faraway place, and they changed the rules of the game on me right there. And I had no choice. I paid the extra $1,000. So I write letters. I do all this stuff. And this shows how the average person has no chance. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason I'm telling the story, because it reflects poorly on me. But I'll say it anyway. After months of fighting with this thing, I called the customer service person in Dallas. And by the way, it's almost impossible to get
right.
a human being.
That's
but
right.
I figured out some way to do it. And I said, here's the deal. I've probably spent 50 hours trying to get my $1,000 back, and you know I'm right. It's 9 a.m. or whatever it was. I go on the air on a radio station in Boston at noon today. At noon today, I'm going to talk about this. Now, this is why it wasn't that bad.
Wait a minute. Was this our previous job?
It was our previous job.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just want to be clear about
and
that.
And I said, here's the deal. It was like 10 years ago. I said, here's the deal. I said, I'm not going to embellish anything. I'm going to tell things exactly as they happen factually. I'm not going to malign you. If you want to come on and respond to it, it's fine. She said, I'm sorry, do whatever you want to do. 15 minutes later, I get an email saying, you'll get your $1,000. No, and the point of the story is not that I don't know if I crossed the line. I came close to crossing a line.
You crossed the line, Jim.
But the point is, if you have that kind of power, you have a small chance. If you don't, you have no chance with these airlines.
None.
They crush you in. They charge you for absolutely everything, maybe except water these days.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's unconscionable. And the only people who could help us are not the airline advocacy rights groups. It's Congress.
Right.
And Congress chooses not to.
Two things, what really, really, really just makes me crazy. Now, I didn't know until reading this piece is that they are trying to move against what was finally changed so that when you went online to buy your ticket, you saw what is the price, what are the taxes,
yes, that's right.
what are the fees,
yeah.
and you get the total fare. Because sometimes you go, oh, wow, $274. And then you click on the thing and said you're going to buy it. And by the time you get to the end, you realize, oh, no, this is a $400 ticket because they didn't tell you all the stuff. And they're now required to do it. Now they're trying to get Congress to make that go away. So once again, you would only see the base price and get surprised at the end. Surprise! It's really not that.
But
it's more.
Is it any better to actually do it on the phone with the person?
They charge you extra.
Oh, they charge you.
How much extra?
Yeah,
like usually 25, 50. Yeah, if you deal with a human being,
yeah.
it's extra. So you have to try to navigate it yourself, which is one of the reasons you make more mistakes, which they want you to make.
Right.
Once again, the fact that we can't take the train from coast to coast and every place in between, I mean, I don't think they do that to you on Amtrak, do they?
Well, no, they haven't done it thus far. Here's the only thing I would mention about the airlines is disgusting. They think they pretend like they're so compassionate when something horrible happens, like a big snowstorm and people are stuck. we're going to waive the change fees. Really? Because there's a billion people in line. Maybe that's why you're waiving the change fees. But, you know, that's the only thing they give you in terms of any kind of dropping a fee or reasonableness, is because everybody is stuck in Chicago and they weren't supposed to be there because of a snowstorm.
Okay, let's go from one consumer issue to another one. Supreme Court of the United States heard arguments on this Aereo case. Now, most people, I'm guessing at least a significant chunk of the audience has no idea what Aereo is. You want to tell them what it is and tell them what the issue is?
We started talking about this on Beat the Press about a year ago. It's a little tiny antenna. It's like as big as your thumbnail that sits somewhere in a warehouse that you can rent, like as much as you might, you know, rent space as you do on for your cable system to get your shows. Except with this one, you can get exactly the shows you want. And the fee is very, very small. It's not the hundreds of dollars that everybody's paying to the cable company. Well, the broadcasters are yelling about this and fighting them, and have gotten it to the Supreme Court to say, wait a minute, you are allowing people through your antenna to pick up our programming, which we paid for. We paid to have the actors, we paid for the, you know, the writers, we paid for the directing, all of that stuff. And you're just getting it free and it just passes on to them. And yet, you know, you're going to make some money off of it from the people who subscribe, who have the individual subscriptions.
And just to fill in the blank, meaning you do not have to pay a cable fee. You don't have to pay the cable company. You circumvent that.
That's right.
And pay a modest fee to Aereo.
So I, for one, would be thrilled because I wouldn't have all that crap sports stuff. I could get exactly what I wanted. It would be just great. Now, having said that, I've been listening to the arguments on both sides, and, you know, as the Supreme Court justices heard both sides this week, and I can understand the broadcaster saying, wait a minute, if I've invested money making these programs, you don't get to have it for free. Something else has to, we have to be paid somewhere. This is a violation of copyright. They're arguing that it's not a violation of copyright because the airwaves are given to the broadcasters and they're free to us, and this is just a, you know, picking up a signal. Whatever happens here is going to revolutionize how we get our media and what happens. ABC and Fox, I believe, and maybe a couple of other networks, but I know that, CBS and Fox have said, if this goes through and Aereo is vindicated, we're going to take our broadcast signal off, all our programming, and put it on cable. So the only way people could access it would be to purchase a cable subscription. That will be our way of getting back to make certain that we get the money we think we should get for our copyrighted material.
Wow.
Whether they do that or not, I don't know, but they could.
And by the way, one interesting thing to give you a headache about this case, you would assume, in light of the fact that cable companies are losing a ton of dough as a result of Aereo, they'd be opposing Aereo. But interestingly, they're siding with Aereo because if Aereo wins, they can use similar methods to get local broadcasting signals so they don't have to pay the billions of dollars in fees to local channels for transmission rights that they do. So there's all these strange bedfellows. But I think what Callie's point is the most important one, which is regardless of how the nine justices rule, the impact of this on the television viewer, and some of us are becoming more television viewing these days, as we'll discuss with Bob Thompson in a little bit, than we ever were before.
Well, my niece does not watch TV. It's Netflix.
Yeah.
Forget it.
My daughter, too. Yeah. I think a lot of kids now, forget it. They don't want to pay the cable companies. And if the cable companies didn't make your life so difficult, they might last longer than they're going to last at the present rate. But in any case,
you only have a minute or two here.
Yeah, we got to be quick about this. The Charles Street AME Church has had some financial problems. It's an historic church in Roxbury. Lots of people know about it. Tell us what's going on over there.
Well, this has been going on now for about 2 years. The news came out then when the bank, which was holding its mortgage, One United, said, you owe us a lot of money, and we've been waiting patiently, and you've been dancing around, and you haven't given it to us. And everybody was shocked because both institutions are, you know, pretty large, and certainly in the African-American community and very well respected. Charles Street African and Methodist Episcopal Church is well-regarded, and its minister, Reverend Gregory Groover, on the school committee, you know, on all kinds of other things. I mean, just, you know, really well-respected. And One United Bank, big institution, and its whole reputation was trying to make certain that certain institutions in the African-American community got some mortgage help.
It's black-owned, so, by the way, we should
that's
say.
Right.
The bank is.
Because
yeah.
in the past, that hasn't always happened. Those communities have been redlined. So when this came out, it was a big deal, and Charles Street pushed back and said, no, we did this, we have a co-partner, and there is another church that sort of co-signed with them, and we're fine, and here's what we can do. And their first offer of what they could, how they could pay back or do whatever was really kind of lame. And so the bank got mad, as they should, and said publicly, that's not acceptable, and we need something more. So this has been going on in the background. So finally, they've come up with a deal, which really requires them to sell the community center for which they borrowed a lot of money from One United Bank to expand. That's a way to pay it back. But the bank says even if they do that, they will not pay back all that they owe. So the bank, with the deal that's now on the table, is not very happy, feeling like they have not been well served. Partially served, but not well served, and they're quite angry about it. But all in all, it was shocking when this news first broke, and it's still a little bit shocking to see what's happening with Charles Street, and they're going to have to, it seems, no matter what happens, whether the One United Bank is satisfied or not, at least sell the community center, which is the reason they borrowed. I think they thought they could make some income from the community center, pay it back.
Very quickly on this, is that there's a huge outpouring of politicians, as we discussed with Charles Clemens yesterday, to help touch 106.1, get back on the air. I didn't see in this story. Is there an outpouring?
Initially, there was. Initially, Mayor Menino went right to the church, stood next to oh, yes, and a lot of other people. And some people said at the time, while you're rushing over there, you may want to wait a minute to see what's going on with the church and whether or not the church is really standing on the solid ground that it says it is at that time, and that One United Bank is coming across as like the Scrooge. It turns out, because you don't hear too many times about churches being foreclosed on, but in the reporting of that story, whenever we started, about 250 banks, I think, had been foreclosed on by banks. So it is happening. It's just very sad that these two institutions that are well-regarded ended up in this position. But right now, it doesn't look like it's going to be resolved, even with the selling of the community center.
Hey, Kelly, thank you.
Okay, Kelly, thank you very much, as always, for being with us. Kelly Crossey, of course, she's the host of Under the Radar. You can catch her Sunday nights from 6 to 7. Thanks again, Kelly, for coming in. Good luck with your airline tickets.
Yeah.
Up next,
it's
Open Mic with Alex Beam with his big reveal. Finally, we can mention the name of his book. It's no longer forthcoming. It's in the bookstores right now. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Remember last winter? Well, here's one good thing that happened. More than 10,000 sustainers earned their very own WGBH production credit. Now, it's your turn. Sustainers break their gifts down into monthly installments that automatically renew. And if you sign on as a sustainer before the first day of summer, you might see or hear your name listed alongside some of the best producers in the country. Get your name on the list at wgbh.org/sustainer.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting the reduced Shakespeare company in the complete history of comedy, abridged, now through May 18th. More information and tickets available at mrt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as he does every Thursday for Open Mic, is Alex Beam. And normally at this time, Marjorie and I marvel at how appropriate it is that he's named Alex Beam. But here's the bad news. Our high school intern who writes those obsequious hyperbolic tributes is on vacation. So instead, we're letting Alex's writing speak for itself.
The leading citizens of southwestern Illinois could have imprisoned Joseph Smith. They could have chased him back across the Mississippi and delivered him to his old enemies in Missouri. Instead, they killed him. Why? That is the story of this book.
And that book would be American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church by Alex Beam, out in bookstores now with unbelievably spectacular reviews.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Alex.
Chicago Tribune, LA Times.
Of course, all waiting with bated breath for the Boston Globe to weigh in,
exactly.
As well as the New York Times. Do you get any advance notice of when these reviews will be coming, Alex Beam?
No is the short answer. The Wall Street Journal reviewed a couple of days ago, which was agonizing because it has a paywall. So I couldn't. Anyway,
Wait a minute. Don't tell me you didn't look at the review in the Wall Street Journal.
You had to spend $4 to read it.
Indeed, it did cost $4.
Did you pay it?
Absolutely not. What are you, nuts?
I read it to him.
Yeah.
You have to run to his neighbor's house out there. Would you live in Wellesley? A lot of people get in the Wall Street Journal out there. You could run next door to the neighbors and grab the paper.
Alex, how long did you take to write this thing before you tell us what it's about?
Two years.
When you're writing, is there anxiety? I'm serious about this. Every time we have an author who's done a major work, and this is a major work, do you, as you're getting to the end, say, what if I spend 2 years of my life and people think this is poorly written, poorly researched? How much anxiety is there from the time you finish the thing till you start reading what the alleged experts have to say about it?
Well, I think the honest answer is only a modest amount of anxiety. I mean, I and my friends who are writers, I can't imagine undertaking a project that, I mean, let's rephrase that. I've been lucky enough to undertake projects that were really fun for me to do, that were really consuming and interesting. And so there, the calculus you have to tell to yourself is the book may fail. It's just a totally real possibility for any man or woman, the book may fail, but am I okay with how I spent these last 2 years? And if you can't answer that question yes, you're doing the wrong thing, absolutely. And to not answer a question that you didn't ask.
What is it?
The first time I could kind of breathe easily is like, you know, there's a moment when like, your wife, your cousin, your mom, her sister-in-law, there's a point at which, you know, somebody in the real world has got to read the book and pass judgment on it. And indeed, in publishing, there are things called pre-publication reviews. They're not written by your cousin. They're not written by your publicist. They're not written by your friend. They're written by some underpaid person. And, I got great pre-publication reviews. And second of all, Publishers Weekly, which is a really serious publication and really works hard, you know, like the book. So that was kind of encouraging.
Tell us a story.
Come on, Alex. You know when something's good. You've been writing a column for a long time. You have a pretty good idea if it was good or not good, don't you?
Not with a book. You don't know how it's going to be received.
Well, I wouldn't know.
I don't mean to be a jerk, but you don't know how it's going to be
received.
Okay.
Well, it was received enormously well. So tell us this fascinating story, because I really didn't know much about the murder of the kind of creepy guy that started. Well, that's the way you portray him, as a creepy guy.
I don't believe I call him a creepy
guy. You didn't call him that,
guy.
But you portrayed him that way. Tell us the story of the murder of the founder of the Mormon Church.
Well, Joseph Smith, yes.
Joseph Smith.
Who, for the record, was not a creepy guy.
He was not a creepy guy?
He was a prophet who spoke to God.
Okay.
And a true prophet for 5 million Americans. Joseph Smith was found himself and his 10,000 followers in southwestern Illinois on the banks of the Mississippi River. This was really their refuge of last resort. They'd been chased out of Ohio. They'd been chased out of Missouri. They were very, very successful missionaries. So that's why they had such a huge following in this oddly named town called Nauvoo. And to make my 280-page story short, they just frankly alienated everybody around them. This is the American frontier. And they alienated people for a variety of reasons. They voted in blocks, so they controlled all the politics of the county they were in and the counties around. That really got people angry. They were viewed as heretics. I mean, you have to be straight about that. The Book of Mormon, the notion that somebody had handed to him by an angel a third canonical Bible in a relatively religious land, meaning the United States of the 1830s and 40s, is just way beyond the pale. That's an insane heresy. If he had been in England, he probably would have been burned, frankly. Thirdly, the polygamy was the word was out all across the nation. And I mean, from which means from the East Coast to the Mississippi River, as you know, newspapers printed and reprinted each other's stuff. He was known as sort of old Mormon Joe with his seraglio, you know, that he had a harem. I mean, somehow, even though polygamy was secret and the fact that he had taken dozens of wives.
I didn't know that. Dozens of wives?
Well, there's my favorite footnote in my book. I can't find it. I have an actual footnote saying historians disagree as to the number of wives Joseph Smith. And then I quote three really prominent Mormon historians. One says 36, one says 52. Anyway.
Forgive me for calling him creepy. I found that creepy. I'm sorry.
Well, it's in the Old Testament, of course. I mean, Solomon had 1,000 wives, I think. So, and he's one of the creators of the original Israel, I think. But
1,000?
I think it's in the Old Testament. Bears checking, perhaps. In any event, there's a chapter in my book called Everybody Hates the Mormons. I mean, that's the situation they found themselves in 1844 in Illinois. Everybody hated them. They were also, I might add, economically, there's this word this guy called me out for. They were economically self-sufficient, although I can't be bothered to use the word autonomous or self-sufficient, so I describe them as economically autarkic. But in any case, Mormons even, you know, they would be the first, incredibly insular culture and religion, as they were also at that time. So they were economically totally divorced from the country around them. Mormons did business with Mormons, they helped out other Mormons, and they did not help out non-Mormons. So that's, if you were counting, that's basically four reasons why everybody hated the Mormons, everybody hated Joseph Smith. They had some relatively dubious reason for getting him inside a jail in Carthage, Illinois. And once they got him inside the jail, as many predicted, they simply lynched him, although in this case, of course, they filled him full of bullets.
And the alleged perps were cleared after trial, correct?
Well, it's even sort of funnier than that if you have a incredibly dark sense of humor. I mean, he was murdered in broad daylight, you know, with hundreds of witnesses. And the thugs that actually killed Joseph Smith immediately kind of, you know, as Mark Twain would say, let out for the territory. They crossed the Mississippi River and disappeared into Missouri, which is just a locus centris for Mormon haters. So they put nine other people on trial, people who actually didn't kill Joseph Smith, but people just hated Mormons on principle. And there was this long, month-long trial, and they were all acquitted.
There was some, not to get too gruesome into the details here, but he fell from a second-floor window. What was that about when he was killed? He started on the second floor and wound up outside?
Yes. I mean, I've been to the Carthage jailhouse. And, I mean, for the men and women who are listening who might be Mormons, I mean, they probably know every second of this story. But the so-called, you know, the mob invaded his jail cell, started firing at him, and there's a window there on the second floor, and Joseph was the only one who tried to climb out the window, although he was shot both from the door of his own jail cell, but simultaneously he was also shot from the ground.
Oh.
So he tumbles, some would say lifeless. There's a huge dispute of whether he lost his life by the time he tumbled out of the... But the key thing is that before he tumbles out of the window, he says, Lord, is there no help for the widow's son, which is the Masonic call of distress. It's genuinely fascinating. He called out to the male Masons in the mob because a Mason cannot bear arms or harm another Mason. And a part of my book that is to be fair, a little bit complicated but essential was that Joseph Smith embraced Masonry, which, as you know, takes out ads on the radio right now, is very much alive in the United States. He embraced the ritual of Masonry in part to ingratiate himself with the kind of movers and shakers in Illinois. And it's incredible in a way that his last words were, Lord, have pity on, you know, have you no pity for the widow's son? But it's incredibly dramatic. I'm not a Mason. The Masons just kept shooting him. So that's how much they hated him.
And this is all pre-Utah for people who are saying, what does Illinois have to do with this? Obviously pre-Brigham Young and pre-Utah. You know, I haven't read it yet. I've read all the reviews. And I have to say, it is clearly not, which I think you'd agree, it's not an Irenic book. Would you agree with it? Now, the reason I say
Irenic.
That, whatever it is,
yeah,
here's why I say this. I am reading one of the reviews a couple of days ago. This is in the Chicago Tribune that praises practically every word. However, in the middle, mirroring something that is occasionally said in the studio to Alex, I will read from the Chicago Tribune. Marjorie, while the prose is engaging, it does come with a quirk. Some of Beam's words, how do you say that word? Irenic?
Irenic.
Irenic, autarky, and they mention a few others, live outside the vocabulary of many readers. So you were true to yourself is the bottom line.
To be fair, he goes on to say, he says two things. He says you can understand those words in their context in the book. And secondly, he says, thanks for the vocab lesson.
Hey, Alex, you say at some point this guy said, I'm paraphrasing, Joseph Smith, I guess I may be forced to be president of the United States. Now, his perception, was that perception anywhere near the reality of his power and influence and
well,
that
just
sort
to put
of thing?
That in context, I mean, there was a presidential election in 1844. Joseph Smith was a nationally known celebrity, and he chose to run for president. I think it was utterly delusional. No, there's nothing to back that up. I mean, he did make comments in Nauvoo, Illinois. He said, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm the next president of the United States, and even then thought he might get elected 4 years later. I happen to think that's part of a manic delusion.
So contrast him to Brigham Young that replaced him, and I think many people think of, you know, Brigham Young University, and Brigham Young is always associated with the Mormon Church and stuff. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, to hype my book, which naturally pains me somewhat. I mean, what's interesting.
Can I interrupt you to say, by the way, if you're going to hype a book, the fact that you do not understand that you have to say the title. I'm serious. Every book
American
interview,
Crucifixion.
You
is
say
a great
in
title.
My book, The American Crucifixion. You have to try doing that now.
Say in my book, Better Living Through Yoga.
Go ahead, Alex. Yoga, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to help you out.
No, I understand that. Yeah, the book's called American Crucifixion. Anyway, I mean, I think one thing that's genuinely interesting about the book is that this is a genuine so-called hinge of history. It's a hinge of American history because it's only through the killing of Joseph Smith that my favorite trite piece of writing from my own pen is that, you know, it's only because Joseph is killed that Brigham Young takes them in flatboats across the Mississippi River and, as I write, into the mainstream of American history. I mean, this is the galvanizing event. They realized they're going to kill us if we stay in the actual United States. So Brigham Young, who's incredibly dynamic leader, who's elected, so to speak, in fact, he is elected after Joseph is killed to be their new leader, he leads the Mormons westward to Utah, to the intermontane west, as I choose to call
it. Another of the words, yes. That means between mountains. I looked that up.
Go ahead. Yeah. I mean, it's a truly incredible story. And Joseph Smith had this idea even before his death. He said, we've just got to go somewhere where nobody's going to hate us. We got to go somewhere basically where there's nobody. I offer semi-sincere apologies to the Native Americans. There was an Aboriginal, transient population in the Great Salt Lake. But in any case, they chose a really desolate, arid part of the United States, the Great Salt Lake Basin. And Brigham took them through unbelievable hardship, took people from the Mississippi River across a series of mountains to present-day Utah.
What drew you to this story, Alex? Why'd you write this book?
Why did I write this book?
Yeah.
I was invited to write this book by an editor. I wanted to plug him. He's a graduate of Lexington High School named Benjamin Adams, a resident of Lexington, Massachusetts. He was an editor at Bloomsbury, a terrific publishing house. And he thought if we could get a trade book, a popular history, if we could get the right writer, this could be a great book.
Was there any? Do you have any interest in the subject matter before he approached you?
I did, to be honest.
Why?
I got to be really, really careful. The greatest name in Mormon history, in my opinion, is a woman named Fawn Brody, who's no longer living, and I knew her family in Los Angeles in 1979. She's Joseph Smith's first 20th century historian. She was excommunicated by her uncle, no less, from the Mormon Church for writing her astonishingly excellent biography of Joseph Smith called No Man Knows My History, which is still in print.
Wow, that's a great story.
It is a great story.
And how did, when she, after she was excommunicated, what happened?
She became Fawn Brody, a UCLA professor of history. I just can't stop myself. I'm so in love with Fawn Brody. She's the first American historian who ever linked Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings in her biography of Thomas Jefferson, obviously not with DNA, using so-called historical methods. And at her death, unfortunately, when I knew the family, at her death in 1979, she was working on and published posthumously a book I haven't read and I doubt is all that good, but got a lot of attention. She published a so-called psychobiography of Richard Nixon.
Now, we're almost out of time here, Alex, so we can't go into
American Crucifixion.
American Crucifixion, we've talked about that, but you have a column in the Globe talking about how writers are going to be broke forever, but maybe that won't be true in your case.
Well, believe me, I'm sure. I did time that for the
arrival of this book.
For the arrival of this book, there really is no money in books, to quote my saint.
Yeah, despite that fact, I hate to disclose something in a personal email between me and Alex, but I'm gonna do it anyway. When I say something nice to him about the reviews that I had read, he emails back something in typical Alex Beam fashion. At the end of which, he writes hashtag happy, and then hashtag for once, which I think it sort of describes who you are. Yes, congratulations.
Thank you.
Would you like to tell us,
nice of both of you to take it
before you go, the names of any of the other books, or should we just keep those sub roads for the time being?
By Fawn Brody, by Alex Beam's American
The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. It's called American Crucifixion by the great Alex Beam.
And Alex Beam is a columnist, of course, for the Boston Globe. Up next, TV's Bob Thompson of Syracuse University gives us his take on the latest on late night host Musical Chairs. And what happens when a Coen Brothers classic gets adapted to the small screen. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
today at WGBHnews.org. Are community colleges only as good as their part-time faculty? If you missed it on the radio, on-campus reporter Kirk Carapezza has the evaluation at WGBHnews.org right now.
This is Greg Wong.
Stay up to date with the latest in high-tech news, personalities, companies, and trends with the Xconomy Report, presented in partnership with Xconomy.com. Friday mornings at 7:50 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at HarvardVanguard.org and experience better care for a better life.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. We've seen a lot of movie stars make a big splash on the small screen. Claire Danes, Kevin Spacey, Matthew McConaughey, just to name a few. But what happens when a big movie moves over to TV? The latest example, Fargo.
Kitty said they just got one of those fancy European all-in-ones. Says it washes and dries one machine. Can you believe that?
That's at the Beck and Benny.
You can afford it, your brother. Kitty said he just got a big promotion after only working there a year. So I married the wrong Nygaard.
Oh.
That's what I said. We had our good laugh.
Well, it's just slow now at the shop.
You gotta try harder, hun. Smile for Pete's sake. Maybe wear a nicer tie.
You gave me this tie.
Well, if you were a better salesman, I'd have bought you a nicer tie.
The Coen Brothers classic is now a TV series on the FX network. Joining us for his take on this and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communication at Syracuse. Bob, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. You know, that's not the first time they tried turning Fargo into a movie. It was done by one of the networks many, many years ago and never got picked up and... The pilot was played once on Bravo, I think, when Bravo was doing that brilliant but canceled series.
Well, you know, when you hear the clip of that, you keep thinking the same thing. You think about when people try to do Boston accents here in Boston. Is that really the way they sound in Minnesota?
It is to me.
I don't know. But Jim is obsessed with this now. He goes from obsession, 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 Bob Thompson, these different TV shows. Is this worthy of his obsession?
Well, there's only been one episode, unless I've missed one. I think the second one. Well, actually, I think there's been two episodes. It's on Tuesday nights. The first was, though, a long pilot, I think about an hour and 37 minutes, something like that. And it was really, really good. I mean, it went down like a Minnesota hot dish with melted Velveeta cheese all over it.
Okay.
You know, Bob, when I saw this, and by the way, I didn't like it. I loved this this show. I love Martin Freeman anyway in virtually anything, and he obviously is terrific in this. There's a little Twin Peaks. There's a little True Detective. There's a little Breaking Bad. You know, good men can do bad things. I mean, it really takes a little piece, not to mention the brilliant Coen brothers. There is a little borrowing from other things that have been huge successes of late, isn't there?
Right, there is, and I think all three of those that you named are exactly there. I kept thinking about Twin Peaks when I was watching it, although Twin Peaks got so bizarre that it collapsed under its own bizarre gravity. But this takes really good parts of all of those shows you talked about and a number of other ones as well. And that's what's getting exciting about. We've now got enough really good shows out. Television has been doing really good stuff now since, Hill Street Blues in the 80s. And it's beginning to have a conversation with itself, like great painting did, like great poetry and novels and all the rest of it. We're now moving into a television tradition that that's been going now for several years. By the way, completely unrelated, but I guess sort of connected to that, 75 years ago this month, television kind of was officially introduced to the public at the 1939 World's Fair.
Wow. Wow. I didn't know it was that early. I thought it was like in the 50s.
Was Milton Berle selling
any until there wasn't any regular programming until after the war, but RCA had a big display, and you could see the president open the fair on TV screens and all the rest of it. Then the war came along, and TV development kind of stopped, and most people didn't get TVs till early 50s, as you pointed out.
We're talking with Bob Thompson from Syracuse University. No, I don't know if you can identify this line. Maybe Jim can. They're talking about these great lines in Fargo, and one of the reviews talks about this great line about Chaz is working the ham, where he's massaging it grotesquely to improve the flavor. What is this about, please?
Do you want to do it, or shall I, Bob? Take it away.
Well, no, you seem inspired, so you go with the ham.
What was he doing?
Great scene. We just heard that clip a minute ago. Martin Freeman is the under-accomplished husband of this woman who was nagging him all the time. His younger brother, who treats him like garbage, is a very successful, making a lot of money. They go to the house of the younger brother for dinner, and they walk in, and they say, "What are you doing?" And the younger brother is massaging with his fingers this half a ham. And what did he say? He saw it on Martha Stewart or one of those shows to make it more tender. And it's one of those things where it doesn't sound so great when you describe it, but when you see it, it is a classic, is it not?
Well, and what is the line, you keep doing that to the ham, you're going to have to marry it.
Yeah, that's
God.
That was good. You know, Bo, I think I asked you this a couple of months ago in the context of True Detective. This is a 10-episode deal, and I can't remember what your answer was when I asked you that. Is this because big stars like Thornton and Martin Freeman are just available on limited bases, or is this the new strategy? This is the way to capture an audience because they know it's of limited duration. Why are they doing this?
Yeah, well, the main reason is the first. Let's take True Detective. You can't get Harrelson and McConaughey to sign a 7-year contract or a commitment to do 7 years of a season, whereas you can get those people to do 8 episodes. So that's the main thing. The nice beneficiary, though, is you can do all kinds of really cool things if you're going to do a show that's going to end after 8 or 13, and you get to move on. And we've been sneaking it in again through things like American Horror Story, which has got one title, but every season is a completely new start. And this goes back to the old idea of the miniseries, which was big in the 1970s, and the British have been doing this for a long time. But the problem with the miniseries is they had to be these big, elaborate things. They were almost always based on best-selling novels, the Shogun, the Winds of War, and Roots, and all the rest of it. Here, you can do these small, quirky, weird little stories like True Detective and now like Fargo, and you can tell it, and when you're done, you can stop. And TV in America never used to be able to do that. Yeah. It was kind of like, you know, if Beethoven would have written the Fifth Symphony for ABC, ABC would have said, "That was great. Can we have 4 more movements?"
Okay. We're talking with our TV guru here, Bob Thompson from Syracuse University. I'm going to steal the opening line from the Times Review because it's so great. Viewers seem to be a little less mad about Mad Men. And the Bill Carter is talking about, of course, the AMC drama, which renewed its first half of it, renewed its final season this year, this Sunday. And the ratings were down hugely, 34%. I was quite surprised.
Right. This is one of those shows, unlike Breaking Bad, which just kept building and building, and when it got to its final season, it had gathered all of these fans slowly but surely who were, you know, catching up with it and picking up, and it went out with an enormous bang. And that could happen with Mad Men as well. This was just the debut, and a lot of people will watch that. Well, those ratings are going to go up as the week goes on and people watch on their DVR. But I have to confess, there is something, even in my own feeling about this show, that is different than the momentum of some of these other programs. I shouldn't admit this because it's my job to keep up with these things, but I am one episode behind the current season of Mad Men. It's on my DVR, and in the old days, the minute I woke up the next morning, that was the first thing I watched. Now it's like, I'm 2 episodes behind on the Lindsay Lohan reality show. Maybe I'll catch up on those and I'll do Mad Men later.
Don't worry, I'm staying caught up for you. And why? But is that because essentially many of the episodes, even though I think the first 2 of this first half of their last season, I hate this division, 7 episodes, then they take a break till 2015. They have 7 more episodes to end, which
that's
I do
right,
not.
Yeah.
Just it is almost like extortion of the viewer. It is essentially the same thing happening and over again. in just different settings. Isn't that really what's happened to Mad Men?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. And I don't think some people have really bailed on this show. I don't think it's collapsed to the extent that some people are saying. But I think you're right. It is interesting to see this go to, you know, from the beginning of the 60s to the end of the 60s, because, of course, a lot of change happened in that decade. And it was change we never really got to see on TV when the decade was going on. When the real 60s were happening, we got witches and talking horses and genies, and it was hallucinogenic, but a different kind than what was happening in the real world. So it's been, I think we're going to be glad to have the totality of this when it finally finishes in 2015. But there is a sense, I think, to some extent, that it's really kind of chugging and huffing and puffing as it gets to the finish line.
You know, John,
as opposed to a thing like Breaking Bad, which just went into a sprint that made us all delirious.
Yeah.
But, you know, you touched on something that I hear people complain about all the time. They wanted it to be back in the 60s. They didn't want to see this transformation, the guy in the office with seven women in bed with him and all this kind of stuff of the free reign 1970s and stuff. But I wanted to ask you, Bob Thompson, you know, people watch TV so differently now. I would have said 5 years ago that the problem for Mad Men is that right an hour before at Game of Thrones, which everybody is talking about, is on HBO. But since nobody watches television in the time slot that that it's on, or a lot of people don't anyway, does it even matter that Game of Thrones precedes it by an hour?
I think with these shows, no. I mean, there still are a lot of people that are still watching network lineups when they're on live on a regular TV. But I think for the audiences of these shows, it matters much, much less. The big fans of Game of Thrones, which is, of course, the huge campus television show now, they're watching it. Most of my students are watching Game of Thrones religiously, illegitimately, on stolen HBO signals that they've never paid for. And no, they're not watching it. They don't care that it's on before Mad Men, after Mad Men. They watch it when they feel.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Usually during my lectures.
We're talking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse University. One last thing about Mad Men. You know, for those of us who are huge Sopranos fans, we couldn't imagine James Gandolfini doing anything else. And unfortunately, we didn't get much opportunity to see what else he could do. John Hamm is a great comedic actor. I think he's been brilliant as Draper in this Mad Men thing. What's the scuttlebutt in your world as to where he goes next?
Well, the main thing is you got to find a project that will release you from the gravitational pull of the thing that you became so known for. And John Hamm has got a little advantage because he has actually appeared on a lot of other things, both since he's been on Mad Men. He's made other appearances that kind of gets him out of that character occasionally. And he'd been on some things before that as well. And he does have that almost generically good-looking look to him, which I think you could pour into a new role much easier than a guy like Gandolfini. He completely inhabits Tony Soprano. He looks so unique. I mean, you look at Hamm and you think, there is American handsome man.
Yeah, yeah.
You look at Gandolfini and you say, there's Gandolfini.
That's so, so true. Hey, there's also another sea change happening. You mentioned broadcast television a couple of minutes ago. Here is a visit that I guess should have told us something, or I don't know, maybe it should have told us something. This is Stephen Colbert visiting the David Letterman show this past December.
He's not as doctrinaire as I would hope. He's not into judgment, that sort of thing. He said, should, like, you know, what do you think about gay people? He goes, who am I to judge? I'm like, you're the Pope to judge.
Right.
He also said that atheists can be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Catholic because I can be redeemed.
Right.
It's like the Admiral's Club of Christianity, you know? If atheists can be redeemed, who's next? Lutherans? It's madness.
Obviously discussing
his... back to Fargo, a perfect circle.
His alter ego. You know, they picked Colbert to replace Letterman so quickly. What was it, 6 or 7 days after Letterman announced that
a
he was leaving?
Later,
the conventional wisdom, for those of us who know nothing about inside the industry, suggests this was a long time in the planning. They knew Letterman was leaving, and they knew Colbert was their choice. That's has to be what happened, isn't it?
I think it does. I mean, that is not a decision they could have made lightly, and I think they have to have brought in Colbert and done a little role-playing just to see, okay, what's this going to sound like when you're not doing the O'Reilly parody?
Mm-hmm.
And I would, if I would have been at CBS before I made that decision, I would have wanted to see some, you know, some mock-up stuff of how this thing is going to look, and apparently if they did that, they liked what they saw.
But are those who like the faux Stephen Colbert, are they going to, obviously CBS, one would assume, has tested this too. Is it the inner Stephen Colbert that they're attracted to, or his brilliant portrayal of this fictitious person? Are they? I assume they've got to be worried about that, aren't they?
They certainly should be, and so should Colbert. And I think, by the way, that's another reason they announced this over a year before it actually is going to happen, so that they can start bringing Colbert out and getting us used to the quote-unquote real Colbert, whatever that means. They've got over 12 months to do that, and I think that's one of the reasons they did it. No, I think this is going to be Colbert's biggest problem is not going to be whether he's funny, whether he's talented. We know all of that kind of stuff. His biggest problem is going to be competing with his own former self.
Mm-hmm.
That Colbert Report and that character he plays is so beloved, and a lot of people, that's the way they know Stephen Colbert. They don't know him in any other context. Even his Colbert Nation, his online presence, is that character. And it's going to take some doing, I think, to for a lot of people to get used to whatever it is that they're going to see that isn't that guy.
You don't sound wildly optimistic about this, but if I may read into your tone, is that fair?
Well, if I would have been a CBS executive, I'd have looked at Colbert's portfolio and I'd say, okay, very hip, got the whole new digital thing down. He can sing, he can dance, he's funny, all of that is perfect. But that other looming thing that we're going to take him away from something everybody loves and drop him into something entirely, I would be concerned about that. I look at a couple of times whenever, and this is not even going out of character, whenever you take Jon Stewart or Colbert out of the shows they are so perfect at doing, and they do those shows they do absolutely exquisitely. But when you take them out and put them in other places, sometimes it works, Colbert talking to the Washington correspondents, and sometimes it doesn't. Remember that mall, Washington Mall?
Oh, yes.
Thing they did?
They had the
that,
million...
That, I think, was really, really uncomfortable.
When they had the march on Washington, yeah.
Stewart will go on a talk show, and he just sounds like a pompous, self-righteous guy who's hiding behind the fact that he's class clown. And so that's what I think. You've got these two perfect shows, and Colbert is on one of them, and they're so good at that. And anything else they do may look bad in comparison.
We're talking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse University. Bob, you know, why is it so difficult for women to break into one of these shows? We haven't. You know, Chelsea Handler has a late night show. Lots
no
of
more
like her, and you know, Joan Rivers. I mean, you're going back like 40 years or something.
Right.
To think someone that was even in contention. What's the deal with that?
Well, it's the people making the decisions. I mean, there is no reason. We have got lots of funny, talented women out there. I mean, in the old days, part of it was there were so few women doing comedy. Phyllis Diller didn't have a whole lot of BFF girlfriends in her field because most of the women doing comedy were doing them as part of male-female pairs. That's not the case anymore. We could probably name a dozen people who are really funny right now who could do a late-night show. And Joan Rivers, back in ye olden days, when she would take Carson's place, which she did a lot, she was a substitute host for Carson, she often got higher ratings on the night she was substituting than on the nights when Johnny himself was there. She was a big star. And she did her late night show, but that was on the Metro Media station. That was a syndicated thing. We have still not had a female in any of the late night slots on broadcast TV, and many people have now made the prediction that we'll have a female in the White House before we have a female on a network late night show, because now the slots are taken. And usually when one of these slots get taken, people have a tendency to stay in them for two or three decades.
Yeah.
But Bob, you said a second ago I could name a dozen women or 10 or whatever you said who could probably fill the slot. Well, name two or three who you think should be on the top if it weren't for the executives who are making the decisions, who'd be on your potential list.
I think Sarah Silverman,
yeah,
a great candidate. She can be really bawdy, but we've also seen her go on Kimmel's show and she can actually behave herself as well. She's affable. She's young. I think she could appeal to a wide audience. I think she'd be a really good candidate. Many people were talking about Ellen DeGeneres. I think actually she's way better on the morning venue than on late night. But if we remember back when Ellen used to do stand-up comedy, and Ellen had a sitcom as well, she is really kind of thing as well. She's not just a daytime Oprah type.
Yeah. No Tina Fey, Amy Poehler kind of thing?
I'm just not sure they would do it. I mean, I'm sure if CBS, the dream of CBS would be not to get Tina Fey, not to get Amy Poehler, but to get both Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
That's exactly.
Yeah. You could have doubled, not only get the first woman in network late night, you could have had two. But I just don't think they're at a point in their career where they wanted the grueling task of showing up for a late night show every night.
Yeah, I suppose they get little kids, don't they, at this stage of the game? I'm not even sure.
Well, I mean,
I'm not sure what their family status is.
Hey, one last thing. When you talk about the risk of Colbert, does he take the risk because late night is sort of the ultimate test for these kinds of people, or does he take it because his salary quadruples? What's the allure?
Well, I'm sure knowing a guy like Colbert, well, I don't know Colbert, but based on what we know of Colbert, I'm sure he made a very rational list with columns on each side. The money is one thing. The fact that these jobs do tend to get legacies attached to them, people do tend to stay in them for a long time. If it works, it's steady business. Now, don't tell that to Conan's Tonight Show staff, but if it clicks, it's steady business. And it's the mainstream. I mean, he is on cable now. He has a disproportionate amount of influence given his audience there. But going into Letterman's slot is still, even in these digital days, the big time. It's why Katie Couric made the very risky job decision to take CBS's anchor slot. It was the top job out there, and she wanted to say she'd gotten it, even though it did not play to her her greatest talents.
Nor does her current show, apparently. So
right, well, exactly. So I think Colbert had a lot of those things, but most importantly, if I were Stephen Colbert, and I'm sure he's thought of this, he's got to be thinking, I've been doing this Bill O'Reilly, you know, cable news parody for a long time, and I don't want to spend the rest of my performing life playing this one character. And if I were him, I would think this is probably not a bad time to try to move away from that. And what better way to move away from it than being offered the second most prestigious job in American comedy?
And the first is?
Yeah.
I guess the Tonight Show.
Oh,
still,
Tonight Show.
I'm not
the
even sure
Show.
That's true anymore.
You know, I'm just thinking about Colbert, Bob Thompson, in character or out of character. He can still raise those eyebrows in that way when he looks at the camera. And
well,
every
and
time
has,
I
have
see
you ever
him
heard
do
him
it.
Doing, he does radio interviews for public radio every now and again.
Yes.
And he's so likable. He's so
he's
charming
great.
And erudite. I can't imagine him not being very watchable.
Yeah, no, well, I'm rooting for him big time because
I
absolutely love him. Bob Thompson, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bob Thompson is the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Ask the Mayor. Mayor Marty Walsh will be here to take your questions and ours. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan.
And don't forget the Friday News Quiz tomorrow, Marjorie.
Oh, my goodness, the Friday News Quiz. Thank you very much, Jim. What would I do without you?
Exactly.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I am the aforementioned Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.